So hopefully you're here for CS 3330, Computer Architecture. You may notice that I'm not Samira Khan. Samira Khan is there. We will be trading off lectures rather than preparing two copies of the same material taught by different people every day. And I'll start by teaching the first few lectures, and then Samira will take a few. So this class, we're looking at the topic of how the hardware actually works that you started in 2150. So we're going to look at the process going from having some sort of high-level language in this course. Our example of a high-level language is going to be C. We'll explain later why we chose that, and how that gets translated into assembly, which you've seen a bit of in 2150. And our choice of assembly language will mostly be 64-bit x86, which I gather is what all of you had in 2150, so you, of course, remember it perfectly, which we'll get to later. You may notice that I have the wrong syntax, if you remember 2150 here. That's what we'll be using in this course, because our textbook uses that, and it would probably be even more confusing to use a different assembly syntax than our textbook. We'll also be talking about machine code. So we have assembly. Now that's the text representation, but turns out that our computers have a bit more of a compact form than a text file they expect to interpret and actually execute. And that's going to be machine code. And you might expect that it would say, well, we do x86-64 machine code. Of course. And that's not what's up here. So we're doing something called YD6, which is an assembly language and corresponding machine code made up by our textbook authors. It's from an assembly language point of view. It's basically a subset of x86-64. From a machine code point of view, it's a lot simpler. That's why we're using it. We could teach you real x86 machine code, but that would be a waste of your time. We'll also be using a hardware design language. So we'll be working on not just looking at the machine code, but going a step further than you ever looked in 2150 of how do we actually build hardware to do that. And we'll be using what we'll call, I wrote down as a hardware design language, hardware description language. We'll be describing the hardware in some abstract way that kind of looks like a programming language. But instead of this programming language, you know, compiling like your normal programming languages to something like assembly, ultimately, this is going to compile down to a description of hardware to build. So we could build our processors by having you like manipulate transistors, and just lay them out on a grid and connect wires to them. That's a real way you can build processors, but that's not what anyone does. You don't build a processor in my laptop by designing it that way. Like, you don't even like take out your tool and like lay out the transistors. No, you write a higher level description, and there are these higher level tools which have their own compilers that compile down to that description of place a transistor here and here and here and here and connect them by wires here and here and here. And that's how people build processors. So we'll be using a tool like that, but considerably simpler than the industrial tools. We don't actually have the infrastructure to turn it into real hardware, though it's the sort of language that could be. We'll be instead simulating it. And you will use that to build something which takes the machine code and actually runs it in a similar way as real hardware would. And we'll talk a little bit about the layer underneath that. So I mentioned that this description language is going to compile to something like a description of you place this component here and wire it here. And we're going to care a little bit about what those components are. We're not going to go into detail like you would in a real digital logic course or something like that about how those components work and what they do. We're just going to talk about the parts that matter from our perspective using a hardware description language. We need to know how some of the components work so we know what they can do, what sort of operations we're going to have available to us, when the component is going to do something, when it's not, and so on. So let's start by talking about our choice of using C. So C is our choice of a higher level language. So it's a convenient language to program in. It's going to be basically a subset of C++. I say almost. Because while it is true that if you look at most C code, you'll say, oh, well, that just looks like C++ code that doesn't use classes, doesn't use new or delete, doesn't use IO streams, doesn't use vector, and so on. That would be what you say, but it's not actually true that C is a subset of C++. If you take a large C program and try to compile it as C++, you will probably find that it doesn't compile because there are some minor, subtle differences in what's valid. These aren't especially important, but it's enough that it's not actually a subset. The reason we're using C is partly because you already know C++, so hopefully teaching you C will be very easy. And partly because there's a fairly direct correspondence to assembly. So this should help you understand the machine. So rather than giving you a bunch of assembly code and asking you what the machine does, we might sometimes want to talk about what the machine does with something that's easier to read. You don't want to like figure out what is this register being used for, you want a variable name. And you don't want to figure out, oh, that's a function call, you want to see a function call. And C, as originally intended, was built in an era when compilers were hard things to make. And C is designed to have a really straightforward way of being compiled to assembly. So there's this direct correspondence where you can manually translate C to assembly in a pretty mechanical way, there's not many decisions to make, and get assembly that naturally corresponds. And you would think that this would be what your compiler does. And it used to be that compilers did work that way. They had this very fixed way of translating C to assembly, but that's slow. And you want your compilers to produce fast programs. And typically modern compilers are optimizing. So it won't actually be the case if you look at what your compiler does. It will do the direct translation we're talking about. Sometimes that's going to be what it does, but other times it might find something more clever to do. It might say, well, you did write an ad there, but I know how to do that faster. I know how to get rid of that ad for you. You did move that value into memory, but you don't actually need to do that. It might figure out something clever to do that will make your program do the same thing, and that is a valid thing for a C compiler to do. And we're not mostly going to be concerned about that, but I'm warning you about it because if you write C code and look at the assembly, this is going to come up. You're going to say, I never wrote that. And what's happening is the compiler has some leeway and it's trying to be clever. So it did something that it thinks will give the same effects as what you wrote, even though it's not doing the actual operations you wrote in assembly. Even though doing those operations would be a valid way to compile the program. And related to using C, since we're using C in this course, you need to be able to have some place that you can actually like take a C program and compile it. So your first piece of homework is to get a Unix-like environment with a C compiler. And there are several options. So we will get you Unix lab accounts. You should have them by this weekend. If you've taken 2150, it's the same type of account. This will give you access to remote login to the lab Unix 1.2.3. This is a perfectly fine way to do all of our assignments, if you're comfortable doing that. Another option is you can get some sort of Linux environment, either natively on our VM. The 2150 VM image should work perfectly fine, so if you have that lying around, you can reuse it. Another option that's worked for some people is an online IDE. So I'll mention that I say Linux here. So some of our assignments will actually require Linux. Most of them will just require a Unix-like environment, but there's a few of them where we'll be like giving you a Linux binary that doesn't run an OS X, for example, or we will be giving you an assembly file that will not assemble as is on OS X and link properly. But for the most part, if you have some other Unix-like environment, which usually just means OS X, most of the assignments you can do natively on that, but not all of them. Our general rule is that the supported platform is lab machines. If you have trouble getting something working on your Mac, and it's supposed to work on your Mac, We're not going to have a faculty member or TA spend an hour debugging that with you. If there's other students asking for things, we're going to tell you use the lab machines and SSH, and we will help you do that. That's the official answer. If there's trouble, we're not in the business of doing tech support when we have other things we could be helping students with. We'll try to help out on sort of a best effort basis, but we can't, you know, figure out everyone's individual configuration. So I mentioned assembly. So in theory, everyone here knows assembly from 2150. We know from experience that that is not actually true, that some of this memory gets a little bit lost, or maybe you didn't pay attention to that part of 2150. So we're going to be spending some time reviewing parts of assembly with an emphasis on things that either didn't show up in 2150 or were covered very briefly in 2150. We will also, since in this course we are using the AT&T syntax, the syntax that's based on tools made by AT&T, the inventors of Unix, rather than the one made based on tools made by Intel, using that other syntax, we will go over what AT&T syntax looks like so you can get up to speed on that, because we assume that you don't remember anything about that except that it exists from 2150. Our first assignment, our first lab and corresponding homework, which are next week, is we're going to give you a Linux binary, and we're going to have you use the debugger or disassembler to figure out what inputs it expects. And that should help you get refreshed with reading assembly. So I mentioned we are using our textbook's machine code. So I say Y86, so this has a corresponding assembly language, which is literally an x86 64 subset. So it omits some things, like it has one less register, and it has a lot less instructions. If you actually know the x86 instruction set, if you take Intel's manuals, there are two like 1,000-ish page volumes of just the instruction reference, not the rest of the reference, not like how other things like caches work and things like that. Just the part which says here's the list of each instruction and what it does. You know, that's not something that would be reasonable to have you be expected to know, and we can't just have you, know a subset of it for programming, because you actually need to build a processor that runs an instruction set. So the subset we're choosing is one you have to actually implement all of in this hardware description language, so it's better to make it smaller. So even though it's going to be a lot more awkward to write assembly programs in this subset, because maybe your favorite instruction, like multiply, isn't there, it's going to be a lot easier to implement because you won't have to implement all those instructions. Instead, you'll have a set of like 15-ish of them, which is much easier. So this has a real encoding that I promise is much simpler than the real x86 64 encoding. And yet, it is still substantially more complicated than the toy machine code you saw in 2150. For example, it is a variable length encoding. So different instructions take up different amounts of bytes, and you need to deal with that when interpreting assembly. It has many registers. The IBCM encoding, I gather, has like one or two, basically. It has the full set of conditional jumps. And it has the stack manipulation instructions, which are pretty complicated as far as what they do compared to anything in IBCM. And we'll get to that in a couple weeks. Okay. So a lot of this course will be dealing with our hardware description language. So we'll be doing something to build a simulator of a processor in the same manner that you could actually build a physical processor and have it be compiled down to something you'd give to someone and have them build. And you might ask, well, I'm not a computer engineering major, and I really just do about software. Maybe I don't care about how to build a processor. I'm never going to do that. why should I care? And we'd like to think that this course is useful, even if you think there is no value to actually building processors yourself, that that's something someone else should do. I never want to do it again, ever. And this is that hopefully this experience will help you understand how hardware works in ways which are relevant for you as someone working on the software side of things. So one big topic we'll talk about related to how hardware works is understanding program performance. And in 2150, you talked about one aspect of program performance, which was sort of the more asymptotic complexity side of things. That how do things scale as sizes get larger and so on. And we're going to deal with more smaller factors in program performance, the things which are those constant factors that do make a difference, but aren't the sort of thing where you can look at, am I using the right algorithm? It's, you know, what is exactly my hardware doing to implement that? You know, is each step really fast or really slow? And how can I improve that? And in the naive model you start with for program performance from looking at assemblies, you'd say, well, there are these instructions, and the way the processor works is it reads an instruction, executes it, goes to the next instruction. So the naive model is that one instruction is one time zone. And this is not a horrible approximation, but it's pretty bad for modern processors. Most processors do not actually work this way, where this is a good approximation of how long a program will take. And there are two big things going on. So one is parallelism. So fast hardware, modern processors in general, use parallelism. So hardware is just inherently parallel. It's easy to do multiple things in hardware at the same time, and modern processors do this. So on a modern processor, you might have literally over 100 instructions in some stage of execution, some way partially executed at a time. That is very common to have that degree of sort of parallelism, and some of them are doing some of the same operation at once or different operations at once. And to get the full performance on a processor like this, you need to give the processor multiple things to do. And you as a programmer, by knowing when the hardware will have multiple things to do and when it won't, can make your programs more efficient by making better use of the hardware. The other big issue we'll talk about is caching. So our view of memory is typically that, well, I can access any part of memory and it's all the same. That's not really how it works. We really have things that are accessed recently held in faster memory than things that weren't. And you as a programmer can structure your program in ways which takes advantage of this. You don't just have to rely on having to be lucky in matching what the policy of the processor is for what's kept in fast memory and what isn't. You can deliberately structure your programs to take advantage of caching. And we're going to talk about how to do that. And I note that both of these sorts of ways that performance matter are complementary to algorithmic efficiency. These are things that you'll choose the right algorithm, but when you do, you want to implement it in a way where you take advantage of the parallelism that exists in your processor and take advantage of the caching in your processor. But this is something that you'll do in addition to making the right asymptotic complexity choices. So the second issue I have on my list here is, in addition to knowing about program performance, this class should help you understand more about what compilers are doing. So we're going to talk a bit about some of the more detail about the translation from source code to actual things that are run, and you know, this might help you understand your compiler and linker errors. You'll understand better when the compiler is trying to optimize, what sorts of things is it trying to do, because you'll learn what compilers are good at doing to take advantage of the hardware and what they aren't. And this will also help you in debugging applications. Since you'll have more practice with things like assembly, this will mean that when the compiler is doing generates code that does something weird, and you don't understand why it's segfaulting, for example, maybe you'll be able to look at the assembly in those really tricky cases and figure out what the compiler was doing with your code. Another thing we're going to talk about is going to help you with weird program behavior. So we're going to spend some time talking about parts of the hardware that are designed for the operating system. And the most notable side effect of this that you've seen in prior courses is the segmentation fault. So the segmentation fault is a consequence of one of the hardware interfaces for helping operating systems manage the processor. And we're going to teach you about how that works. And this will help you if you want to write an OS, because if you want to write an OS, you want to use this mechanism that lets you share the processor between multiple programs, and you want to know how that works. And even if you're just using an OS, it will help you understand, well, when can things segfault and when can't they? How does the OS, when is the OS catching errors in my program, when isn't it? It will give you an idea of how that works. So before I move on, any questions about any of the sort of goals of the course, overall things we're covering I've discussed so far? Okay. So now I'm going to go on to an apparently non-technical seeming topic of powers of two. And we're going to talk about powers of two because later on in this course, we're going to have lots of cases where we're going to deal with numbers, counting like bits and things like that, where we're going to have these powers of two. And it would be really handy if you can look at a number and quickly figure out what the power of two is so you can do things. And there's some tricks to this which are not hard to learn. Also, this is a good time to note of how we're going to abbreviate powers of two. So I'm going to represent something like 1024 as K. I know that you might say, well, SI units, that should be 1,000. Why are you off by 2%? We're gonna use it to mean powers of two. We're gonna do the same for M. We're gonna use M to mean this number, which is 2 to the 20th, and G to mean this number, which is 2 to the 30th, and so on. Same with 2 to the 40th for T, and so on. We're going to do this because in hardware, we're dealing with bits. We're not going to have lots of cases where naturally we have an exact power of two for some reason, because we're counting, because there's bits counting something. And we're going to have essentially no cases where we have an exact power of 10. So we care about powers of two, so we're just going to use that notation. We always mean the power of two. I will try to clarify this on exams, so you don't have to remember this, but we always mean the power of two. And we're going to use abbreviations where we might write this here, 2 to the 11th as 2k, this 2 to the 12th as 4k, 2 to the 13th as 8k, and so on. And that's a very handy abbreviation to make. It's an easy to read size, and it's also the sort of thing you're going to read, like if you pick up a processor specification, if it tells you about its caches, it's going to tell you it probably has a 32k cache. It's not going to tell you it has a 32,768 unit cache. And there's this trick here where if you'll note that we have a 1 here which corresponds to this k here, this 10 for k, and the second digit here, this is 2 to the 1 is 2, and here we have a 1 which corresponds to the k, and the 3 is 2 to the 3rd, which is 8. So you can use this trick where we know that when we look at it as a base 10 number, the power, the first digit tells us the prefix, just because it's 2 to the 10, 20, 30, and the second digit tells us what goes in front of it. And we can translate naturally back and forth from this 2k, 4k, 8k writing to the actual power of 2, which is what you want if you have to do some sort of math with the size we give you. And this works like down here. You have 2 to the 31, so that's g for the 30, and 1 is 2 to the 1 g, which is 1, which is 2g, and that works in general. So any questions about what I just talked about? Okay. So since there are none, you should have no problem translating all these to that KMG notation. I'll give you a minute. So I guess a notable first step is that you probably want, that it's helpful, and we would recommend, though we don't require it, memorizing these, that you can figure it out manually as you need to, because it's only the first 10 powers. It's much easier than if we gave you, you know, 2 to the 21, and you multiply 2 times 2 times 2 21 times, and inevitably made an error. Anyone still working? Okay, not volunteering at least. Okay, so for the first one, we're gonna, so the process is we look at our first digit here. This is a 3, so that 3 means we're gonna have a G at the end, which we know because 2 to the 30 is our giga. And then we have 2 to the 5th. So 2 to the 5th is 32. If you didn't have that memorized, that's reasonable enough to compute by hand. 2 times 2 is 4, 4 times 2 is 8, and so on. So for the second one, we again look at this first digit here. And we say, okay, that's m. Because 2 to the 20th n, k, then m, it's about a million, and then we have times 2 to the 1. 2 to the 1 is 2, it's not 1, which is a common thinking quickly mistake, and so we get 2m. For the next one, we have, you should just need to remember that this is, if you write it as 2 digits, it's 0, 9, so we have a 0 at the beginning, so there's actually no postfix on it, and this is just 512. And you know, some people write this as 1/2 k. I probably wouldn't do that, but I won't say you're doing something wrong by doing that. And for 2 to the 14, we look at our first digit. It's 1, 2 to the 10 is k, so this is going to be some number of k. And then we have 2 to the 4, which is 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, so 4 times 4, so 16. So any questions on any of these? Okay. And how about the other way? Anyone still working? So the reverse process, as we look at our digit here, we know that this means, since G corresponds to 30, we know this corresponds to 2 to the 3 something. And we just need to figure out what that something is by figuring out what power of 2 is 16. Remember earlier it's 2 to the 4. If you don't have that memorized, you can just multiply 2 times itself until you get there. And because you know it's less than 2 to the 10, you know you're not going to spend too much time doing that. So in this case, we have 2 to the 34. For the next one, we have k, that's 2 to the 10 something. And we need to figure out what power of 2/128 is. It's 2 to the 7th, which again, you can figure out by multiplying 2 times itself by hand. Tedious, but doable. Or you can eventually memorize it, which is what I've done because I've been doing this sort of thing a lot. For m, a similar process. We take 2 to the 20 is m, and 4 is 2 to the 2, so 2 to the 22. And for 256t, you just need to know that t is 2 to the 40, which a lot of people don't figure out, but it's after gigabyte is terabyte. That's what it, that sort of thing is what it comes from. And so this is what we'll mean in this course when we give you something like 16g. We always mean the power of 2 because we don't care about powers of 10, even though it's not proper in SI units. And I promise you there will be a time later in this course when being able to do this efficiently, it will be really, really helpful. Even though it is not immediately. Okay, so since we're about halfway through, some logistics. So as I mentioned earlier, Samira and I will be splitting lectures, so I'll be lecturing for a few days, then Samira, then I, and so on. It should be the same lecture in each section, so we don't actually care what you go to except for room capacity issues. I think I generally give a better lecture the second time, but whatever works for you. We have coursework. So there will be quizzes. They won't be this week. They will start at the end of next week. We will have a post-quiz for the week of lecture, and in the following week there will be a pre-quiz for that week of lecture. So for the pre-quizzes, you will actually need to read. I'll talk about the quizzes later, and next week I will show you how you will take them. It will be an online interface. I'll show you how that works next week. Also as a reminder to take the first quiz, since a lot of people seem to forget the quizzes in general. We also have labs. So labs are going to be done on the lab days. We don't actually care if you go to lab. There's generally going to be an electronic submission of some sort, and we're going to check whether you submit on the day of the lab. Collaboration is permitted on the lab. We do ask that you be honest about who you collaborated with. And the grading is based on this metric of did you make reasonable progress. However, I am grading an electronic submission. I am not going to be talking to your lab TA and assessing how hard you are working. I need to look at what you submitted and decide, do I think that you were really spending 75 minutes of effort? And inevitably, this is an imperfect science, so I'm going to have some threshold which is below finishing absolutely everything, typically, based on the submission, which is intended to give the idea that if you spend 75 minutes working on it, you should get full credit, but I'm not going to guarantee that because I need to look at what you submit and make an assessment. I'm not going to actually know how long, whether you work for 75 minutes or 5 hours and still gave me something which didn't compile, you know. So I'm going to make my best guess, but the intention of the grading is that often we won't require everything to be done. The intention is that if you finish what we expect most students to finish with 75 minutes of work, you should get full credit. But not guaranteed, because we have to look at your submission and guess. We will have homework assignments. Most of the homework assignments, we will have a lab, and then the homework assignment immediately after lab and due before the next lab will be suspiciously similar to the lab, which is intentional. The homework assignments are individual assignments. There is no collaboration on them. You should not be sharing code. You should not be sharing pseudocode. You can ask general questions as a rule of thumb. The questions you ask should be the sort of questions you'd be comfortable discussing in front of me with another student when I could hear. If that's not true, there's probably something wrong. They're due at noon on the next lab day, mostly. There are some exceptions. And there will all be electronic submissions. We will have exams. We'll have two midterms and a final. The two midterms will be in class. They are going to be multiple choice and short answer, so we can grade them in a reasonable time without having lots of office hours be lost as a result of grading the exam. And the final will be at a combined final time, which is already posted on the final schedule. And at some point later on, you will need to talk to me if you cannot make that for some reason. So the labs and homeworks are not going to be perfectly synchronized with the lectures. And the big issue is that we want to make sure we cover the material mostly before you have to do it in lab and homework, which I think you appreciate. And we have some homeworks which like have different parts building on each other, and this means that inevitably we get a bit of a gap between when something happens in lecture and when the homework actually gets that far. We've tried to make some changes this semester, which will hopefully make this a little better than in past semesters, but I still expect to have some of this thing where we'll be doing something in lecture, and then the homework will get to the part of it where that comes up a bit later, like a couple weeks later, which I'm sorry, we don't have a great way of rearranging things to make things fairly synced up. Just keep that in mind. So I mentioned quizzes. So they're linked off the course website. Next week I will give a demo. Also to remind people on Thursday that there's a quiz after the Thursday lecture. So most weeks, not the first couple weeks, will be different. There will be a pre-quiz on reading. So I would strongly recommend having a copy of the textbook in some manner, because there will be a quiz on the reading. It will be released by Saturday evening and due Tuesday at 10:45 a.m. I choose 10:45 a.m. because that is 15 minutes before the first lecture. And I don't want people doing the quiz during a lecture. There will be a post-quiz on whatever topics we discussed in lecture and possibly lab that week, which will be released Thursday evening, like 6 or 7 p.m., long enough after lecture to give us time to fix the quiz if we didn't cover what we expected to cover, and do the following Monday afternoon. So each quiz is taken online in a browser at your convenience with a 90-minute time limit. We will drop the lowest 10% of quizzes. Generally, the quizzes will have like around 5 or 6 multiple choice, you know, select one or select all that apply sort of questions. Consistently in past semesters, quizzes are the lowest part of almost everyone's grades, which I know is surprising. I would note quizzes also are open book, open notes, but not open questions to other people, like do not post the quiz question on Stack Overflow, do not IM your friends. But otherwise, you are perfectly welcome to like look over the lecture slides, read the book to try to answer one of the small number of questions that you have 90 minutes to do. And given that, it's surprising to people that I'm saying these are the lowest parts of people's grades, but this is how it is. I'm not sure everything that's going on. Part of it is that probably we tend to write hard quiz questions because we like write things that are like hard exam questions because hey, you have the book, you have time, you have a lot of time for the question. And part of it is maybe that some people might be doing the quiz in the non-optimal way. So any questions on the quizzes? Yeah.
So we have a post-quiz for this lecture?
Next week.
So we don't have...
Yeah, the first one is written as next week's post-quiz. They are all posted on the schedule. Okay. So you can read the schedule and find out when they are. Yes?
I'm a little confused by what you mean by the lowest 10%. Is that like the lowest 10% of your quizzes?
So there will be about 21 quiz. So based on how things are now, it looks like we'll have 21 quizzes in the semester. And the lowest 10% of those will be dropped. Well, rounding, that's going to be two of them. The lowest two will be dropped from the grade computation for each person. Not the lowest for the class. We're not going to do anything where you rely on how other people did on the quiz to determine whether it counts for you or not. I don't think that that's a very nice incentive to have people say, don't do so well on the quiz, or something like that. So, attendance. So, lecture. We strongly recommend attending a lecture, at least I do. Smear maybe does. I will be recording all my lectures. This is an audio recorder here. I will be recording a screen capture, barring technical difficulties, which might happen. There will be a recording available on the schedule page of the website. This is intended to help you review. However, you could just decide not to attend lecture and look at the recordings. I do not recommend this, but it might work for some people. I would note that if your idea is, of course I'm going to look at the lecture recordings, and you aren't particularly disciplined about doing that, a lot of people think they're going to do that and don't, so keep that in mind. I recommend attending lecture so you can like ask questions and things like that, but I'm not going to tell you what works best for you. You should be able to figure that out yourself. The labs are electronic, and this semester, every lab, it is possible to submit remotely, so we're not going to check if you're there. Generally, if you want to go to another lab, you are welcome to do so, but people who are actually registered for that lab time have priority. But because it's remote submission, often you'll be able to regularly attend another lab, but maybe not on some days where everyone decides they need help. Yes? Probably, yes. Okay. So, late policy. So, in general, if you have exceptional circumstances, that means you can't do an assignment, that's something that, you know, we might want to make an exception for, like sickness or something like that, let us know. If possible, let us know in advance, because it is much easier for us to make nice accommodations in advance rather than, you know, a couple days after the fact learning you were sick and that's why the homework isn't handed in. If that's possible, I know it's not always. So for homeworks, we have a no questions asked late policy of the following form. That if you submit it between 0 and 48 hours late, we will subtract 10%, meaning we will grade it as usual, then multiply your grade times 90%. If you submit it between 48 and 72 hours late, we will grade it as usual and multiply your grade times 85%. If you submit it later than that, we will grade it as usual and then multiply your grade times 0%. We will grade it, we will tell you how you did, we will just not give you credit. But we're always glad to tell you how you did on an assignment that you didn't get to finish. For quizzes and labs, we will generally not accept late submissions. For quizzes, our electronic quiz tool will show you the answers after the quiz is done. And show other students too. Because the answers are out there, we don't really want you taking it late. Also, we want people to feel free to discuss quiz questions they had trouble with after the quiz is done. Like on Piazza, you know, that doesn't really let us let people take it late. For labs, for some labs, we might be able to arrange a late submission for a special circumstance, but sometimes we're gonna release what is effectively a lab solution to help people start on the homework. Not for every lab, but for a few of them. And when that happens, obviously, it would be very weird to let people submit it late when they could download a solution from us on the website that we've given them to start the next assignment. So we generally will not accept late lab solutions. If there's a special circumstance in those cases, we will have to make some other sort of accommodation. Yes?
Since labs are supposed to be turned in on the lab day, does that mean they're due like at midnight on Wednesday?
They will generally be due, yeah, at the end, at midnight on Wednesday. Yeah, electronically. Okay, so for getting help, we're going to have office hours. So in addition to getting help by physically going to lab, where there will be TAs, we'll have office hours, which will be posted on a calendar on the main page of the website. We don't have it posted yet. Office hours will start following next week's lab. I will also have office hours. Office hours will be in the location posted on the calendar, or Thornton Stacks if the calendar doesn't specify. We usually have most of our TA office hours in Thornton Stacks, but not all of them. Sometimes we can find a nice room in Rice, especially for times when there's less people in office hours, that can be better. And professor office hours will generally be in professor offices. So, question?
Just going back to the homework, how far is that?
So there are tentative write-ups for most of the homeworks already, like right now. When I mark it as tentative, I might make changes. Probably not major changes, but I might make changes, so it's a sort of at your own risk thing. But you're certainly welcome to look at it and start working on it, but something might need to change. Some of the homeworks require some infrastructure that might not be set up properly right now, if they're tentative. So you should be aware of that you're accessing some site, it might not be set up to actually really accept submissions yet, or might not have the right set of things on it. But I will try to post them as they're available. There's some assignments which I plan on doing substantial revisions to of some sort, or there's one lab that would be new, which aren't there. But I try to make it available and indicate that it's tentative if I might decide I need to make changes to it. Okay, other questions? So in addition to office hours, we have Piazza, where you're welcome to ask questions and hopefully have students answer them. Try to be useful there. Those are both good ways of asking questions about the course material. And as a reminder, your things you actually need to do, you should have your lab account and or C environment working by next lab. And hopefully you will get a lab account by this weekend, probably today sometime, but at least by this weekend, which will be at least one Linux-like environment that you can use. So any questions about logistics? Anything about how the course works, assignment, deadlines? Yes?
Do we need to submit our labs on our own lab times?
The question is, do you need to submit your labs at your own lab times? In general, you can submit your lab anytime before the end of day Wednesday, and however the electronic submission for that lab works. Other questions? Okay. Okay, so let's start talking about a bit of technical material in our remaining time. So, 2150, you probably learned the model that we have processors that take things like instructions and data from memory and somehow use them. And so our notion is that there's some sort of connection between the processor and memory, where the processor sends an address to this thing we call memory, and the processor gets back data or sends data along with that address to store or read from memory. So there's one component we're missing here that's important if you want an actually working computer, and that's that we probably want like a keyboard, so you can or some other sort of input device, because computers where there's only a memory are pretty boring for actually doing real world tasks. So a common solution to that is to have something in between the processor and memory that can talk to either memory or I/O devices, but use the same interface. That the processor is going to send an address, which might correspond to memory, or might be some special address corresponding to like a keyboard, and it's going to get back data, or it's going to send data that it says is attached to that address in some way. And so the typical operation we learned in 2150 presumably is this sort of get an instruction, run it, get the next instruction. So we have the program counter, the current instruction at some value. The CPU sends that into the IO bridge. The IO bridge says, oh, that's a memory address. I'm going to send it to the memory. And the memory sends back the instruction at that address. So I've written it as assembly, but it's really going to send back the machine code for that. The CPU is going to read that. It's going to figure out, OK, what does it mean to do push based on the machine code? And then it's going to decide, OK, I want to run the next instruction. I'm going to ask for that and keep going. That's sort of the basic operation of our processor. And if we're, say, doing I.O., the CPU is going to say, OK, there's a special address for an I.O. device. I'm going to ask for what the value at this address, for example, send a request for that address. And this I.O. bridge is going to decide, oh, that's for the keyboard. I'm going to ask the keyboard. The keyboard's going to say, oh, this was a key press of A. And it's going to send that to the CPU. And it's going to read it basically the same way it reads a memory address. So this is what our CPU does. So we have our two big components, our processor, which decides what operations to do, and just makes these requests to this one little portal to the outside world, where we have addresses and values that we either read or write at those addresses. And the typical case is we imagine talking to memory, where we read an address, and we read back the value that was last written there, and so on. But I/O devices, we can use the same interface, but the meaning of reading and writing is a little different. And this is basically what processors are doing. So we're going to talk a bit about what memory looks like when we're running a program, and what memory is in general, things that you may or may not remember from 2150. So first, let's talk about sort of our abstract view of memory. So our usual view of memory, usually we ignore the I/O devices, and we'll in fact do that for most of the semester. So we just say memory is just addresses that all store values. And we have address, all these possible addresses, and each one has a byte stored in it. This is our notion of memory. So it's basically an array of bytes, and the CPU decides what these bytes mean based on how it's accessed. If it's reading an instruction, that means that that byte's going to be machine code if it needs to read an instruction. If it's reading the byte because there's a move instruction, that means it's a value to put in a register. So the interpretation of the byte is based on what the CPU's instruction that causes it to read is doing. And I've drawn the bytes of memory in this way, where I have the lowest one at the bottom and the highest one at the top. That's an arbitrary choice. I could have done it the other way around. For this class, for the most part, I'm going to use this way, where I have the lowest address at the bottom and the highest at the top. But that's equally valid as the other way. It doesn't change what's in memory at all. And that's an important thing to know, is that, is that this is just how I'm drawing the thing that's numbered in a particular way. There's another related concept, which is going to come up a bunch in this class, about endianness. Endianness isn't about how I write the values in memory. It's about how I deal with translating between the numbering and getting bigger values. So here, I have some C++ code. And what I'm doing is I'm getting a pointer to a 4-byte value starting at address 42000 in hex. So that's going to mean is that these 4 bytes I have highlighted are somehow going to make up of that one single value. So there's the idea of endianness, which is about how do I decide whether, the byte at 42000 comes at what place in the number versus 42001. Endianness is about making that decision. And when we talk about endianness, we're referring to how the numbering, the addresses we have, correspond to the actual value we're going to get. And so there's basically two options here. So one option is I can say that the value at the lowest address is the least significant part of the number. By least significant, I mean if you change that value, it has the smallest effect of any part of the number on the actual numerical value of the number. The other option is I can say the part at the lowest address numeric has the is the most significant part of the number. That if I change that 0, 0 in the bottom number, it has the biggest effect on the overall value of the number. And both of these options are completely valid, and you can find real machines that have decided to do both of these things. So in this class, we'll all be doing the first option, which is called little endian. And this is because x86 decided in its design that it's going to do things in this little endian order. When you run the assembly that corresponds to this, it interprets it in the little endian way, not the big endian way, when putting the value from memory into a register, where it has to decide, is the least significant part of the register coming from the lowest address or the highest? It makes the decision that it's the lowest. So the rule is that little endian means that the least significant byte is the one with the lowest address. Big endian, the lowest address, is the most significant byte. So you can think of the little or big as being about what is the thing with the lowest address in the number. Is it the little part of the number or the big part of the number? That's how I remember it. You might have some other way. So I mentioned this will come up a whole bunch of times in this class. It's important to remember. And this is, note that we have this decision because we have this labeling, and there's no natural order to these bytes that tells us whether we choose either of these ways of turning it into a number. For the same reason that I could have written the memory going up or down as far as which way addresses go. So any questions about endianness? Yes.
So when you declared the pointer, you used big endian.
So when I declared the pointer, I used big endian is the question. And the answer is no, kind of. So in English, when we write numbers, we write the most significant part of the number first. We don't write the ones place at the beginning of the number, we write it at the end. And because I'm using a programming language designed to be used by people who read English, it writes its numbers that way. So in that sense, yes, but it's not encoded as bytes and that sort of thing. It's just we're writing the number like we would in English. And in English, we always write the most significant part of the number, the leftmost. Yeah. So endianness is about when we have a numbering, which is numbers first. So in this case, we haven't numbered the digits of the number, right? Here. You have one that you say is first because you read from left to right, but I could number it starting with 0 or starting with 0 at the right end. So it doesn't really have an endianness for that reason until we decide on what is digit 0 of the number. Other questions about endianness? Okay. So we've talked a bit about memory. And you may remember this sort of diagram from 2150 about how memory is used by a typical program. So we have our stack, we have our heap, or things like NuGo, we have our data and our code. And the addresses I showed here are the conventional layout, not everything's going to do this, on 64-bit Linux. Other systems might be different. But we have this layout, we have a stack, and on x86 our stack grows down, meaning that the top of the stack, the place where the next thing on the stack is at the lowest address. And when we add to the stack, we subtract from the stack pointer. That's going to be our convention throughout this class. Not the only thing you could do, but that's what x86 does, so it's what we're going to do. We also notice that we have these big holes. So we'll talk later in the semester about what those actually mean. But yes, memory doesn't actually match our illusion of every possible byte has a value. When you're in a program, you have these holes, which are segmentation faults. There's no value there. You try to access it, your program crashes. We'll talk later on about how that actually works and what's really going on. But this is the program's view of memory, does have these holes. And we have this conventional layout where we've decided we're going to put the code in a particular place and the heap in a particular place and the stack in a particular place by convention. And you should expect that as far as figuring out what programs are doing. And something needs to figure out how to produce this data down here, this part of memory here where our code is and our data is. And that's, you know, our process of taking a C file or C++ file and producing an executable. It's going to produce, the executable is basically the image of what goes there. What's the code and data, and what's the initial values of the writable data so we can load that into memory. And you may remember our multi-step process for doing that. You think you've seen in 2150. We have some C code, we compile it, we turn it into an assembly file. That assembly file gets assembled into an object file, which you probably saw in 2150, but didn't really talk about in detail. And then that object file gets linked into an executable. And if we have a C file like this, when it gets linked into an executable, we need some extra stuff. We have here a call to printf. Printf is a C function in the C standard library that's basically equivalent to C out. And this C file here, this very short C file, well, there's no implementation of printf here. Like, we don't have the code that actually knows what printf does here. There's no copy of that. You might say, well, maybe it's in this standard io.h. But if you look in standard io.h, typically you'll have a declaration of printf, but not the actual code that implements printf. So it has to be somewhere else. It has to end up in our executable, because it better be in memory when we load the machine code for the program so we can call the printf function. And so the way that's going to happen is that behind your back, the compiler is going to link in somehow the actual copy of implementation of printf, which is some other object file that the compiler knows where it is. And it just does this for the standard library unless you tell it not to. It just knows, adds all those object files and links them in, so they're part of your executable, so you can call all those functions you expect to work. And so you remember our compilation commands. You can compile, assemble, link. And you have these commands that you probably more commonly use, where you just give a C or C++ file and you get an executable. So how does that work? Well, it actually does all the steps. The compiler just hides the files from you. It generates a temporary assembly file and a temporary object file, and then generates the executable, and then gets rid of those temporary files. But it's actually doing every single time all the steps. We never, ever skip the step of compile, assemble, link. We always do the whole process. So any questions about this sort of compilation pipeline? So I'm going to talk a bit asking about what's in object files. And so I want to make sure you're on this first. So I'm going to go through the process of taking this hello.c, where I'm using puts, which is even simpler than printf, as it's just a function to output a string. So here's our hello world program. And we're going to translate it to an executable. And so there's going to be each of these steps. So our first step is going to be to compile the program. So our compilation step is going to produce an assembly file, in this case, hello.s. And this is a straightforward translation of the source file. So we have some stuff here, which is about the calling convention. We're allocating space in the stack because the calling convention says we need to do that in this case. We're doing the things to call puts according to the calling convention. We're moving its argument, which is a pointer to the string, into a register and calling it. And then we're returning zero. And you may notice that in this file, we also have some labels. So here we have a label of main. So this is how we tell the assembly where main is. That's not an assembly instruction. It just says main is the instruction, the subtract instruction. That's where main is. And we have a label here named .lstring, which it points to the string hello world. And we use that here in order to load RDI. So we're taking the address of that. We'll explain AT&T syntax later and why there's a dollar sign and why the move is in the wrong order next time. But I assure you that loads the address of that string into RDI. And so we have that representing that address. And the next step is we're going to take this assembly file and convert it to an object file. And the main thing that does is we have all these assembly instructions, and we want machine code instead. So the main thing that our assembler is going to do, it's going to look at the subtract instruction, look up how do I write a subtract instruction in machine code. It's going to do that. It's going to look at the move instruction and so on. So we're going to do that. And we're going to get some sequence of instructions. And this, in this case, is the text segment. So in our assembly file, we marked part of it as text, meaning that's where our code is, and part of it as data. And we're going to keep these in separate parts of our object file. So our object file is going to have the machine code for the text part, and it's also going to have the data somewhere too. Because we need to have the string hello world somewhere, how does it get in the executable? Our linker is going to take the .o file, not the .o file and something else. So it needs to be in the .o file. So we're also going to write out the data segment here, which is, this is going to be the ASCII encoding of hello world. And here I'm showing you things in hexadecimal with nice readable labels. The real object file is in some binary format that's more compact and easier, like, to copy the bytes into something else. But I'm just showing you a human readable version of it. But it's not actually the case that a typical object file will have things written in hexadecimal. They'll just put the bytes there with the header which says there are 16 bytes of stuff following, or something like that. So one thing you may remember me saying here is that we had like something which said move the address of L string into RDI. So that's going to turn into machine code. So let's think about the correspondence here. So we have our subtract instruction. So that's pretty straightforward to generate the machine code for. I'm not going to explain why that's the right machine code, but you know, it's always the same every time. So that was easy for the assembler to do. But here, in our move instruction, we have a problem. We have this address of a string that needs to be put in our move instruction, but we don't yet know where the string's going to be. We don't know that yet because, well, we don't know like where our constant data segment's going to be and whether the string's going to be at the beginning of it or somewhere in the middle. We haven't decided yet all the object files that are going to make up our executable, so we can't actually fill that in. So what our assembler is going to do is we're just going to leave a bunch of zeros in the space where the address of the string is supposed to be. And the same thing is also going to be true for putS. It's even worse. We don't know where putS is going to be at all. We haven't seen the file where the code for putS is, so we can't know what value to put in the call instruction to let the processor know how to jump to there. So we're going to, again, leave a placeholder. We're going to leave a bunch of zeros because we don't know it yet. And this is the sort of machine code that's going to be generated. We have these holes because we don't actually know the addresses of everything, all these labels. And since we have these holes, we better have these fixed later. So we need to write a note to remind us that later on when we do linking, that we need to fix those zeros that we left there. Because if that's in the final executable, we're going to load zero, null, as the argument to putS, and it's going to crash. Can't do that. Also, we're going to try to call zero, and it's going to crash. So we better fix this, and we're going to have to write a note to do that. And these notes are called relocations. These are saying, here are the placeholders I have. So for example, 6 bytes into the machine code, I had the address of L string, which was at the beginning of my data segment. So I want you, linker, when you actually use this object file, to replace the 4 bytes starting at that 6 bytes with the place you actually put the data segment. I just left it as zeros because I don't know where you're going to decide to place things in memory. But you, linker, you know where it's going to end up in memory, and you're going to fix that for me. And similarly, we have something for putS. We say 10 bytes into the machine code, you should put the address of putS there so the call instruction actually calls putS and not nothing. So these are notes for the linker to use. So we'll make this for every time we have something where we didn't know the address to fill in. And we need one more piece of information. So there's one thing in this assembly file that we definitely need to produce the correct executable that is represented very clearly in the assembly file. It's not in this object file. Yeah?
Is that the stdio.h library?
So the question is that stdio.h? So, kind of. So I mentioned earlier that the compiler would automatically include the right object files. So as long as it does that, we don't need any representation of stdio.h. Because what we need to know is that the function is called quinis. And that's hopefully all the information we need as long as we supply the other object file. But it's not obvious that that's true. Yeah.
The main label.
The main label. So we need to know, we need to start at main. The executable better actually start at main. And we could have had another function before main in the assembly file, and we would have expected main to be called first. So we better have some way of representing where main is. So there's going to be another part of our object file called the symbol table. We'll call each of our labels that gets put in the object file a symbol. And that's going to have main, and it's going to say main is at the beginning of the text segment of this file. And so this way, when we actually link our executable together, we know where to start. We know where main is. Otherwise, we don't know. We just have a bunch of machine code. We don't know what it is, what functions are in there. So we're going to take this object file, and we're going to link it together with, in this case, the implementation of stdio.h, which hopefully our compiler just automatically provides for us based on, regardless of what we included. And we're going to produce an executable. And basically, what the executable is going to be is we're going to copy the text segment, but fill in each of those relocations. So we're going to take each relocation, and we're going to fill it in with the actual address where things actually are going to be placed, which we can figure out because we know everything that goes in the executable. We know where everything's going to be in memory because we know all the object files. And we're going to also have the data and a copy of the data from each of the object files that make a part of the executable. And we're going to fill in all the addresses based on how things actually get laid out. And when we're done, we'll get this massive binary here where essentially what we have is going to be this. This is we just copy the exe file is basically the code and constants and the writable data. So for essentially, when the operating system loads the executable, all it does is copy the executable file into memory at that address. That's all it needs to do. It doesn't need to do any other fancy processing. That's the idea of doing this linking process. So that's what we're producing, that part of memory, which is the only part of memory we need to start the program. So any questions about what's going on here? Okay, so given that, here's a question. So I have a program here, main.c, and I'd like to ask you which of these files contain the memory address of say hello. So I'll give you a minute to think about it. You can ask your neighbor. See if you agree on the answer. I know some people are still thinking, but we're almost out of time. So who thinks it's A, B, C, D, E, F. Okay. So mostly split between C and D. The best answer is C. So the only time we've decided where in memory say hello is when we produce the executable. Before that, we have an object file, and depending what else we link in into our executable, it could end up that say hello ends up at any memory location whatsoever. So we can't possibly have the memory address in anything else. It might not actually be the case that the memory address is in any of the files, if like we somehow don't need to call with the memory address, because we haven't told you how the compiler actually translates this to assembly. But the only file which could possibly have the memory address is the executable, because before that we haven't decided where it goes in memory. Okay, that's all for today, so see you on Tuesday.